Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to This Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are pleased to welcome back Bob Fitzwilson, founder and managing partner of the Portola Group, one of the financial advisory groups we endorse here at Peak Prosperity. Today, we're going to discuss the markets. U.S. equities are powering to all-time highs, or are close, yet the cross-currents are numerous. How does one safely navigate these waters? As mentioned on my prior podcast with Bob, there is a business relationship between his firm and Peak Prosperity, the details of which are clearly spelled out in the write-up accompanying this podcast. Hey, Bob, I'm very excited to have you back.
Well, thank you, Chris. I'm excited to be here, too.
Well, let's start here. Dow win streak hits nine up days in a row. I think it's the longest winning streak in 16 years. We have to dial back our time machines to 1997 in order to experience something like what we're experiencing. Bob, what are we experiencing?
I think what's really driving it is the afterglow of all the trillions and trillions of money that it was spent from QE1 to the present. And then I think starting last year, it was just outright purchases of the marquee names in the stock market. The frustrating part of it, a lot of it is real. There have been companies that have done very well with the wind at their back, starting with March of 2009. But I think the action, certainly in the last couple of quarters, has the look of an invisible hand behind it. At the same time, the economic series are starting to roll over. If you look at the leading economic indicators, retail sales, unfilled orders, things like that, they're starting to roll over. So I think the bottom line is we're coming to this crunch point where we've spent an amazing amount of money to buy the best recovery that we could get, which wasn't much. And now the question is there enough firepower behind the invisible hand to keep it going?
Well, that's interesting. So let's talk, about what's good out there. But let me start with what's mysterious to me. So I noticed things like Boeing, the Dreamliner. They've invested a lot. It's clearly got some problems. They haven't figured out the battery issue yet. If you had bought Boeing just before they announced this mini crisis, this setback with the batteries, you would have outperformed the S&P by about 1,100 basis points, about 11%. It's fantastic. When I look at Netflix with a PE of over 600, Amazon, I don't even know what its PE is. It's got to be in the thousands at this point, 3,000, it's something. How do we make sense? Would those be frothy issues in your mind, or is there something fundamental there that I should be looking at?
Well, I think they're different issues. The Netflix one, I agree with you. I just scratch my head. The PE is just astronomical. Amazon, you kind of have to look at Amazon as a work in process. They've made it real clear they're building out their infrastructure, it's not something that I would choose to invest in, but. We've all missed a heck of a run. So those two are a little bit different. Boeing, the most frustrating experience in the investment business is when everybody hates something, when everybody knows all the problems are, it's the time to buy. And so Boeing looks to me like a classic example of that. We're also big believers in cash flow. And, through all their troubles, Boeing, the last number I saw was about $7.50 in cash flow. And so that's with the deferred sales and all the problems. So the Boeing one to me is just the classic frustrating investment experience when you know all the bad stuff, that's the time to be buying something.
All right. And then let's talk about where you see there's some real fundamental basis for the valuations that we're seeing right now. What is it that's caught your eye and that you're invested in?
Well, a large part of this is just common sense. And so we tend to get away from rules of thumb and adjectives and small cap and mid cap and all that stuff. And we try to look for businesses that and themes that make sense. And, we've talked about Food being a theme. We've talked mm-hmm. about energy being a theme. Mm-hmm. Water's another good theme. They're actually, you know, one of the things I was thinking about today is that if you're looking at alternative energy, silver is a great alternative energy play. It's also a great monetary play, but you can't get all that the megawatts they're talking about building out in the solar area without silver. Another theme is that, you know, it used to be that as California goes, so does the rest of the nation. Unfortunately, we've been heading as a state in the wrong direction. But the beneficiaries of that have been the states that are doing well. And so you could say that North Dakota is a theme, Texas, the state of Texas is a theme. If all these people are moving to Texas, they've got to have places to live. There's got to be infrastructure. The Bakken trend is a major theme for us, the Eagle Ford trend. One of the ones that's not intuitive is the airline business. There are a couple of airlines that are just generating huge amounts of cash flow and doing very well.
Real honest cash flow? Because the airline industry is something that for, it seems like decades now, it just is perpetually in a cycle of win some, lose some, but overall it's been the return on equity from the airline business overall has just been horrendous for quite a while now.
No, it's really a failed model because it starts out when you don't have any planes, and so you buy a bunch of equipment and you build out your routes and all that, and so just from the depreciation alone, you're generating huge amounts of cash flow, but you're not replacing your aircraft or maintaining them as you probably should. So there definitely is a life cycle to that business model, and so the ones that I have in my mind are ones that, as you can guess, are probably newer and aren't quite as far along in that cycle as the other ones are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, 'cause you have to have good labor. You know, when I say it's not intuitively obvious, you know, when you think about rising oil, you'd think they'd be having troubles. But, you know, these other two airlines, they have very good labor relations, and that's a significant factor in their cost structure, too.
Interesting. Well, as I look out, I'm you know, obviously reading the first hints of the Fed exit strategy, and we all have to watch it very carefully because these markets are, of course, obtaining at least some of their valuations due to the largesse of the QE efforts, which you started out with. And so we have to keep our eyes on where we are in that story. How closely do you follow the Fed at this point in your position? Is this something you keep a half an eye on, or is it really front and center to how you strategize and think about what you do?
I would say front and center. I mean, to a large extent, you know, our thinking, once we realized what was going on, our thinking was that there would have to be a limit to the QE. And we thought there would be a limit to the budget deficits, things like that. And the truth is, I think there's only one path ahead for the Fed. And, you know, the Fed, in our view, is the mothership for the rest of the central banks. And that is that they have to get nominal GDP back on an upward path because you're going to have, if you are increasing debt, you've got all these unfunded obligations. You're going to have to get the GDP up. You're going to have to make people pay more taxes, feel better. And, you know, to some extent, the San Francisco Bay Area, at least the west side from San Jose to San Francisco, is a good example of that. The Fed, if you will, is the money flowing in, chasing startups and buyouts and IPOs and stuff like that. And there has been a huge amount of money generated between those two cities, and San Francisco is absolutely booming. So you can see in that microcosm that the wealth effect actually does work. Now, if you get outside of that peninsula, it's a completely different story in the grand sense. But you know, evidently Texas is doing quite well, and North Dakota is doing quite well. So I guess you have to kind of look for areas that have a positive inflow, and it's generating this wealth effect. But you know, as far as an exit strategy, I don't see how you do that. I mean, you're generating, you know, shadow stats figured it was around $7 trillion a year in actual income minus expenses plus unfunded liabilities. So, I don't. The only exit strategy for me is some sort of a currency reboot, there's no turning back in our view. So given that their goal is to keep assets or get assets higher in nominal terms, I think investors have to play along. And that's the problem, is that most people, the vast majority of assets are currently invested in things that generate a zero to negative real rate of return, and they don't want to go into the stock market. And so I think for investors, you kind of have to just be incredibly disciplined, and you have to keep your powder dry, and then only buy things when it absolutely makes sense to you, that it has a great long-term potential. And turn off the TV. Don't listen to any of these financial programs. Most of it is extremely short-term oriented, and most people have zero chance of playing along in that game. But I do think it's probably the best environment in 40 years for people who are going to use their head and common sense and do a little gumshoe work to find out companies that do have great long-term potential.
I want to back up 1 second. You mentioned a $7 trillion number from ShadowStats. I believe that you're referring the actual accrual-based deficit for the federal government?
Yes.
Yeah, and so when you're running deficits like that, there's really no... There's only two options, you do or die, right? The Fed really has to get nominal GDP up. It has to target that. Nominal GDP, according to ECRI, the ECRI Institute of Business Cycle Analysis, they noted that in the past 40 years, every single time we've had nominal GDP below 3.7%, we've had a recession. And that's where we happen to be at this particular moment in time. And they had some other indicators in there, too. One, they noted that there had been two negative quarters of operating earnings growth. And so that's a slightly different definition than usual earnings growth that we see. And that also had always been associated in the context of a recessionary environment. When you're looking at macro statistics like that, is that giving you any caution here?
Again, you can see the afterglow of all the money they started putting into the system in early 2009. And so the real economy is starting to flag, no question. And so we've got stocks at all-time highs, stocks and bonds. I mean, it's just crazy. So we've got this terrible choice. Do you play along with the Fed targeting nominal GDP and frankly, the other G20, too? It's not just the Fed.
Right,
Japan's
right.
Done the same thing. Yep. Or do you do what's prudent historically and to stay in short-term fixed income, or even laddered fixed income? And the problem with that is that the more money they throw at this problem, the more a greater reduction in the purchasing power of your assets. So it's not a great set of choices. Although you can't, I think it's a mistake to think in too grand of terms. I think you need to pop the hood on the economy, because somebody's always making money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised there. Plenty of companies with, and not just airlines, but a lot of industries that are making a lot of cash flow, which is what we like. And I also ran a screen on dividend payers. The quick screen was between 4 and 8% yield payout ratio, less than 70%. And, it came up with like 130 names, and it was fairly broadly diversified, a lot of different industries. So people should not be frozen. They need to be proactive and use their heads and history and common sense and then just wait and pick things up one at a time.
A lot of this rests with the idea that the Fed can control interest rates forever or for a lot longer. If interest rates really begin to rise, obviously that's going to take one of the legs out of the stool. First is that Bernanke's been horsewhipping everybody into the markets, whether they want to go there or not. I thought he had a completely inappropriate response at the congressional hearing recently, where he observed that the plight of the elderly retiree living on fixed income should maybe take a gander at the stock market and note the great returns there. Obviously, very inappropriate advice. And so people who are of an age where they're not really in a position to be in the market, stock market, are certainly in difficult times right now. But if interest rates begin to rise, then this would clearly knock at least one of the pillars out from under the equity stool, as it were. And the second pillar might be what you mentioned, which is the relative value of the dividends as they currently exist compared to interest-bearing instruments would also begin to suffer. If interest rates begin to rise at any point in time, that would clearly be a shift in this overall trend that you're talking about now, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah. No, I started my career in the early 70s, and people were just devastated because interest rates marched up, and so bond prices, because it's an inverse relationship, bond prices just went down, down, down. And then the inflation hit, and then whatever was left over was destroyed. You know, probably a good resolution for this for most people, because most people aren't inclined to pop the hood, is to spread it out between short-term cash kinds of instruments. And, you know, I would tend to favor treasury bills. It's a terrible investment, but at least it's sort of the mothership. Think of it as a short-term holding period. And then this is where the energy and the gold and silver come in, because if inflation is going to devastate the money that's in cash and fixed income, at least you can hope to have an offset with those real assets. And then just try to find either a fund or an advisor, or if you do it yourself, things that are quality income. You know, if I had to pick one mistake that I've seen in my 40 years is people stretching for yield. It's just, you know, you hear it from everybody, I need income, and yes, you do, but virtually all the scams start out with somebody promising a yield that's higher than is common sense.
It's in the series Downton Abbey, which my wife really fell for, there was one period in there where the patriarch of the house is considering this wonderful new investment opportunity he'd heard about involving Charles Ponzi over in New York City. He was very excited by it.
Well, it's an emotional connection. Somebody says, I can get you 12%, and people start writing checks. And oftentimes it has to do with second deeds of trust and things like that. And so, you know, if 10 years at 2 and somebody offers you 12, just run.
Yep. All right. Well, how about all of the things that I've recently written about, including the idea that there are a number of headwinds now. One, just it seems that the organic growth in the economy through the consumer is not strong. Now we have these additional headwinds potentially from the payroll tax cut expiration. We have the Affordable Health Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, starting to trundle into the situation. We've got sequester and other political realities that are going to constrain federal government growth and spending at this point in time. So considering how large the government is in terms of the overall economy now, with that at least stalled and potentially going in reverse, how does that factor into your thinking right now?
Oh, in a major way. I mean, I'm looking at the, new orders for all manufacturing, that's just plunging. It had a huge rise once they started the 09 QEs and all that stuff, but now it's plunging. You know, everybody's talking about how good retail sales were today, but a lot of that's gas, and that's been heading south. Unfilled orders is plunging off of a cliff. So I wouldn't want to communicate is that I'm not seeing the same things you are. All I'm saying is that there are, if you're inclined and have the ability to do some homework, there are some things that are going to do well regardless of what we're talking about. But if somebody just looks at stocks in general, then they probably should pull back to the sideline. If you look at, the margin debt's at a new high, I mean, all these classic signs. And so for us, the bottom line is that Bernanke said he's going to keep doing this, and frankly, it's his only option. So you're either forced to tag along with him or do what's been smart throughout market history. And for most people, the smart thing to do is miss a little upside but save falling into a 30-40% decline.
Absolutely. There's a lot of signs of topping, so I'm watching them carefully. I'm sure everybody is. And yet we have the Dow hitting all new win streaks. I guess today was powered, there was a little bit of a rise today, nothing too great to talk about, but there was a 1.1% increase in sales, which you mentioned a lot of that was actually due to gasoline. There was a little bit of rebuilding there from the auto side. And then also there was an inventory build today. There's a couple ways. I saw that spun very positively. They said businesses are bullish on their prospects, so they're building inventory. Of course, there's a different way to spin that, which is inventories are building because it's not being sold. Which do you think it is?
I think there's spin everywhere. You know, it's hard to know. I think we do know what's real and what isn't. real. It's just for most of our lives, we've been spun on everything. It's just that in the last few years, the facade has been pulled back, and now it's just outright spinning. And, it, you know, for the long term, people need to generate positive after-tax and inflation returns, but that doesn't mean you should be invested all the time. And so this is a time, unless you're very, very focused like a laser on opportunities that you think are going to transcend this, you need to head for the hills.
I agree. I do like the themes, though, that you've identified. The consider North Dakota and consider Texas to be little mini Saudi Arabias, as it were. They're actually developing, you know, pulling out huge amounts of wealth out of the ground. And that's flowing principally first, you know, there's some pieces of that that flow into the local economy. And just to put a number on it, if, you know, the Bakken is probably this year, it's going to hit something close to 1 million barrels per day if it gets on track, maybe by year end, maybe 2014. Well, at $100 a barrel, 1 million barrels a day is $100 million coming out of the ground. Now, a lot of that gets shipped off out of there, but, you know, North Dakota's taken a piece of that. It's not a very populous state. So that's going to have an extraordinary boom effect for that economy. Similar story for Texas. There's actually quite a lot of wealth that comes out of the ground, and that does, of course, create true wealth effects. That is real wealth. How do you play something like that?
But this is a great way to look at it. Just pretend that they're countries and with an ecosystem. And so in the Bakken area, you know, my understanding is that the infrastructure still isn't completely built out. They were having to truck the oil out. And so they're, you know, somebody's supplying all that pipe and trucking and, you know, valves and pumps and all that stuff. And so what I would look to do is, in essence, that money is like QE for North Dakota and QE for Texas, and just figure out who the beneficiaries would be. In the case of Texas, it's not, you know, they have the Eagle Ford trend too, but they have all kinds of other things going for it. You know, I think I read that they're projecting a $9 billion surplus. They've got all these people moving in. That requires services and cement and building products, and frankly, you know, people have to get there. So, you know, how do they get there? Is it by car, by train, by moving company? So there, again, for the people who are inclined to do this, there's plenty of fertile ground to be chumming for companies that'll stick out in events like this.
All right. Well, let's play a little what-if game. Let's pretend for the moment a recession hits. It doesn't have to be particularly deep, but one does strike, is actually recognized coming into these next two quarters. First question is, what happens to stocks in general under those circumstances? And secondarily, how do you think the Fed might respond?
If we're not in a recession, we're heading there rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like today's gain on the Dow was 5. It's not exactly a resounding bull market move. So, S&P looked like it was up 0.14%. So I think what they're trying to do is, and hoping to do, is to have people see these headlines about Dow hits record for X number of days, et cetera. But the truth is that, you know, this is, it's almost de minimis. I mean, it's not a bull market. It, you know, as you know, volume has fallen off. Now, taking the flip side of this, if somehow all these things that we've just discussed look like they're going to get fixed, there's a humongous amount of money not in these markets, but people need to wait. I mean, there'll be plenty of time in the future to spot a true breakout, but you know, being up 5 and having anemic volume does not qualify for anything.
Oh, absolutely. And if so you're seeing then that there's signs of topping and that might be prudent to sit and wait if somebody's more of a casual investor at this point.
Yeah, because you can't buy Netflix, you can't buy Amazon.
No, I can't.
I mean, I'm not trying to pick on those companies at all, but we're kind of witnessing an aging economic bull market, and the Fed is running alongside, spraying it with water to try and keep it going. But so what will we see if it really starts to roll over? I think the Fed still has, and the other central banks still have capability, and it would be now or never, because if economic activity rolls over, which it is, then it's going to be a problem not only for us, but, you know, I read that Italy's 1,000 businesses a day are closing in Italy. Mm-hmm. There was a really comical one in some sense. Today, the IMF came out and said that Greece was their top performing economic pick for 2016 at 3%. And my understanding is that Europe is China's biggest trading partner, and China's mixing it up with Japan, and so it's a mess almost everywhere. And so it really comes down to how big of a wallet do the central banks have. And you know, when you say it's do or die, it's more like make do and then die for me.
There's
no way out of this.
I follow, and that's a different story. Of course, we have to make investment decisions today. And one of the things I'd like to discuss with you then, if we widen our view out just a little bit, on a fundamental basis, so I don't really follow the Dow all that closely because it's not apples to apples. If you even said the last time Dow was in this territory was 2007, I believe there's five completely different components in there. You know, subtract a manufacturer and install an IT company. So it's hard to put that on equal footing. I tend to trust the S&P 500 a little more because it's a larger weighting. Looking at the S&P 500, the last number I heard was a little north of 40% of the total revenues of that composition come from outside of the U.S. borders. So that could be Canada, Mexico, Europe, Japan, somewhere, not inside the U.S. And so now I'm looking at the dollar here at a multi-month high at 82.92 today. It's powering up. In the past, the stock market has been fairly sensitive to that, and for good reason. As the dollar climbs up, two things happen, right? Exports get to be a little bit tougher because your products are more expensive as a U.S. company. And second, the Forex conversion is you sell in some other currency and repatriate that money after swapping it through. That of course, is unfavorable as your currency is rising going forward. So when you're looking at the global picture, which you just started to allude to, is not strong. There seems to be Japan's already in recession. Europe's in recession. Those are fairly large markets for components of the S&P. Stocks ultimately are about earnings. How do we square the circle between a rising dollar and falling global activity and what we're seeing in with future earnings projections as they are configured for the S&P?
Well, you know, for me, I sort of popped the hood on the dollar index, and my conclusion is that the bulk of it is in Western European currencies and the yen. And so my conclusion is that the dollar index is kind of a sock puppet. It, you know, dollar goes up, euro goes down, but it's just basically attention diverting in the short term. And so, you know, if the dollar goes down, all those currencies have to go down together, and we may get to that point. But the opposing force to that is the yuan and gold. So I see it as a battle between the Western central banks and Japan against the yuan and gold. And so I think we'll just get this back and forth thing until we get, if and when we get some sort of discontinuity there. But you're right, as far as at the margin, our exports get more expensive. But, you know, you do get the sense that because of things like the Bakken and the Eagle Ford and people are, and this is just my gut and anecdotal, but people are going to be buying less of the inconsequential things and putting their money into important things, that it could be a bit of a renaissance for U.S. manufacturing. And I mean, we've got a huge increase in lower cost energy. I think a lot of the products being demanded are starting to more and more being made in the U.S. So maybe the export side of it isn't in general as important as it used to be. I mean, Boeing, I think, is the, at least it used to be, the largest exporter. You know, they have a pretty strong lead in aircraft, so that'll probably continue almost no matter what. This is the most extremely frustrating environment for anybody trying to figure this out. There's so many moving parts. It's just, that's why I say people need to step back and just say, okay, what makes sense for me and my family? You know, just common sense wise, I should have some cash, I should have some gold and silver, I should have, you know, food, I should have some dividend paying things, I should put in a garden, I should develop another skill. I mean, those are the real things that people can do, and if you worry about all this stuff, which you and I do, it'll drive you crazy.
Well, so somebody should do your crazying for you, is what you're saying, and that's a good
well,
thing.
Well, either find somebody who does that for you. Uh-huh. Well, it's both. Find somebody. First of all, do the things that you can do yourself, because not everybody has, a portfolio. They've got some savings. But the most important thing is turn off your TV and then find somebody who has a philosophy that makes sense to you. And pay no attention to track records and things like that, because what's really important is what the person's going to do with your money tomorrow. And does that make sense to you?
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So as you look across the landscape right now, the risks that you might see, do you feel that is there any possible way to control for the macro risks that might be out there? For instance, Japan's doing everything it can to toast its currency. If they succeed beyond their wildest dreams, is there any possible way to plan for that, or do we just have to sort of react if and or when that happens?
I would almost ignore it, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, the road is littered with people who tried to make bets on currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would focus in on, again, common sense things, trying to find advisors with common sense. Because otherwise, particularly with global news and global financial programs and all this in the Internet, everybody can get wrapped up and they get huge amounts of data but almost no information. And you get data overload, and then you want to just bury it in the backyard, and you can't do that. So I think if we're worried about the markets in general going to cash, there's nothing wrong with that. But then you have to protect yourself by having something that will do well in case there's a discontinuity or just a general erosion of purchasing power, and that's the energy and the gold and silver.
Well, fantastic. I like the simplicity of that in this day where everything seems to be so confusing and not fairly opaque and not open to being well analyzed. And so there is a sense here that there is a little wait and see. We know that the Fed has pretty much dealt its hand. It's been very transparent about what it's going to do. I think it started with Bernanke's speech in Jackson Hole and way back when in 2006. And he's pretty well played that out as promised. And so your expectation going forward is more of the same, I would suppose, from our policymakers.
Well, it really is a fight between very powerful entities, the way I look at it. On a global scale. And it's not, there are many of these entities. And it's kind of like everybody's, we're in this calm before the storm where everybody's, pushed and pulled and nobody's getting what they really want. And so it's really set up for some chaotic event. And, the Western central banks still have plenty of firepower, and I expect they will continue to exercise that. But when they do, from a strict inflation standpoint, every time they keep printing money, then it's creating inflation. Maybe it hasn't shown up in the statistics, but it's happening for real people buying stuff. So I think so. At some point, there'll be a resolution between the jockeying and juxtaposing of the big players on the grand stage. But for the rest of it, you don't have to try and handicap that whole thing. You just use what history tells us, and that's get into real assets. And if gold and silver isn't your thing, then find something that historically has preserved value. But now's the time to get out, not trying to handicap it, and then think you're going to be able to react, because it's going to happen rapidly whenever this thing breaks.
When you say it's going to happen rapidly, what are you talking about?
Throughout history, when empires and civilizations hit the skids, it's not a linear decline. It's and particularly when it comes to currencies. I think the people in control learned from the 70s that rising interest rates, rising inflation, rising gold, rising unemployment, these are all things that upset the population. And so they've done a magnificent job of corralling all these things. But the question is, how long it's a coiled spring. I mean, how long can you corral this before something pops on you? And if one thing pops, they're all going to pop. And so, that's how I see it resolved, is we'll all kind of play along. But if something really pops, then we'll get a new currency. There'll be a press release some Sunday night. Actually, in Venezuela's case, it was Friday night, where it's just announced we have a new currency. And that's why going to cash is problematic. It's different than anything else in our life, because if you go to cash and they do this Friday or Sunday night special, you could get wiped out.
Absolutely. The two words that occur to me at this particular juncture of history are capitulation and complacency. And the capitulation is just about everybody I know is sort of capitulated to the idea that the Fed has all of this really well in hand and that nothing's really going to break. And it leads to this sense of complacency that the Fed is really all powerful, which is why I really enjoy talking with people such as yourselves that were through the 1970s. The Fed was very powerful then too. It clearly didn't have everything under control. And that's the nature of history. There are whole quiet periods where a sense of control is in existence, and that feels like it's going to perpetuate forever, but they never do. Something comes along, upsets that. And as you mentioned, that coiled spring idea, we haven't really undone any of the structural things that were there that caused this first crisis to happen, which, by the way, I start this in the 90s. It wasn't a 2008, subprime crisis. That the pieces were put in place a long time ago, and we've just traded little short, relatively survivable recessions for these entirely too big to fail moments. And so when I say it's do or die, really the thing I'm holding under that is this sense that what the Fed is trying to do is prevent any downturns at all and micromanage or macromanage all of the things that arise as a consequence of that. And it's a little bit like they've, like a can of beans that's been tossed in a campfire. We're going to hope that it doesn't blow up, but eventually it probably will, because the pressures are building is the theme I'm working with here. And I can't quantitate all of that, unfortunately, but it certainly doesn't feel right to me that we're talking, like, just one example at the federal level. You know, they're going in conniptions over this 2% sequester, piece. And really in all of that, nobody is talking about the fact that last year, on an accrual basis, the federal government racked up between $6 and $7 trillion of true deficit. And that's the real deal. And so 2% in that context it's meaningless. But yet the government will make it through sequester. Everybody will breathe a sigh of relief and say, well, see, we dodged that. So these things aren't really an issue. And of course, the bigger issue hasn't been addressed. It's still sitting there and it's just cooking along. And that same set of pressures, a similar type, I see cooking along in the monetary side. $85 billion a month is pressurizing the can, and who knows what'll happen or when it'll happen, but my sense is something will happen.
Well, the sad part for me is that most of this is imaginary. You know, at last I heard it was $220 trillion were the accrued promises that we've all made to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a form of mass insanity. I mean, you know, everything around us is real, but these promises we've made are... they sounded great over the last 40 or 50 years, but they can't be paid. And so the can of beans is going to explode, because just the arithmetic tells us that it has to be that way. So the question is, do you deal with it, and you and I would probably be in the camp that you deal with it now and fix it, or do you try and keep the can from exploding as long as you can and hope it happens on somebody else's watch? And I think that's what politicians tend to do.
Absolutely. And still, people have to decide and make decisions where they're going to put their money. No decision is a decision. So we all have to make those decisions. And we've been talking with Bob Fitzwilliton of the Portola Group, one of the financial advisor groups that we really admire and respect. And Bob, I personally admire and respect you and what you bring to this. So thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it.